We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
Well, there are five headings for today's talk on page 10 and 11. And under each of those headings, there'll be subpoints shown up by David on the way through. But for those of you who missed yesterday and who'll be listening to the tape that you're buying later, I tell you that the procedure here is that you spread those five headings out over the two pages and we'll fill in the details underneath. For those of you who were here yesterday and the writing got so small towards the end as you cramped more and more points on the page, can I encourage you to listen to the tapes? Not every talk I give is necessarily worth getting the tape of later, but especially the first two of this series, and therefore what follows, I'm sure, but especially the first two are the kinds of talks that you do need to get tapes and keep listening to, because there is an enormous amount of material we covered at great pace yesterday, and today it's not quite as much material, it's just more intense and difficult. So it's the kind of material that we'll repay listening to over several times. It's got to do with not my brilliance and genius that I can cram so much material into a short period of time, but the very complexity of this topic of tolerance. This is not an easy topic for us to deal with. It's a hard topic. It's one that's out there in our society. It's in there in us. We've got to deal with it, but it hasn't come from the Bible. It's not a biblical topic. It's not that you can just look up tolerance in your Bible dictionary and expect to find the passages that deal with it. It's a concept that's outside the Bible that we're having to work hard to see how the biblical teaching reflects upon it. So that is why I think you'll need... Now, did Ms. Demidenko lie? Or Helen Darville, if you know her by that name. And if she did lie, does it matter? Thanks to her, this last year has seen the Australian literary community having to wrestle with truth and lies in ways that they haven't done for a long time. Because, thank you, David.
That's a little excessive, brother. Thank you. The voice.
Now, this is an intelligence test, I can see.
There we go, done by an engineer.
Haven't said anything nasty about engineers yet, have I? Give me time. She has caused the literary community to really wrestle with truth and lie because she wrote, at first appearance, to be a Ukrainian writing a historical fiction. Under the new category of language, a faction, actually. It's not really fiction because it was history, but on the other hand, it wasn't really history. It was a story that she made up. It's a very difficult concept and category of truth, and I don't know where librarians put it. They've got the fiction section, the non-fiction section, and the faction section. But then it was discovered that some of her history was very questionable. And then it was discovered that her identity was questionable, that not Demidenko the Ukrainian, she turned out to be Darville the Pommy. But she had won the fiction award for Australia. She'd won it under the pseudonym, but then again, lots of great fiction writers have written under pseudonyms, haven't they? I mean, after all, Alice in Wonderland was written under a pseudonym. I mean, there's great literature under pseudonyms. And Bacon wrote all those Shakespearean plays too. So it was quite normal for people to write under pseudonyms. That's all right. So was it all right for her to lie like this or not? And there's been great breast-beating in the intelligentsia and the literati of our community as to whether they've goofed off completely and awarded a prize to a second-rate writer or whether it really was all right. And those with Ukrainian interests have been particularly interested in the matter. She lied. But doesn't everyone? I mean, our political leaders lie. In fact, they tell us they have to lie in order to be able to govern the country. It's questionable whether they can govern the country, but they do able to lie. It doesn't necessarily follow that because you lie, you can govern the country. But apparently you can't govern the country without lying. Although I don't know when the last person has tried to govern the country by telling the truth. I can't remember. I'm not that old. Polly Toynbee is an English journalist, an anti-Christian journalist, and she wrote a little article piece a while ago that I was sent by an English friend in which she said the lie is at the centre of civilisation. Little toddlers, before they're able to think clearly, can't tell lies. It takes them till the age of 3 or 4 to learn how to do it, she says, which indicates to me that she's not a mother. And animals can't lie, and she said people afflicted with autism can't lie, and that's why they can't enter into society and civilization. Now, to be able to lie is of the essence of being human, and it's a good thing. It's not surprising from an atheist. Nietzsche, the great atheist of last century, wrote, asking the question, a great man, who is he? He is the one who rather lies than tells the truth, for it requires more spirit and will to tell a lie. That's atheism. That's the way it is. That's where it leads to. In the Australian Weekend earlier this year, Weekend Australia, January 6, 7, there is a long article here on the rise of irrationalism. A growing hostility towards science by the academic left threatens the contemporary university, writes Roger Sandall. And he continues at a point. Several writers even claim that the theory of relativity was culturally constructed, arguing that Einstein's part was relatively minor and that his ideas were little more than an intellectual reflection of social trends. Just a sort of accidental effect, really. While denying the truth-seeking activity of men such as Einstein is part of the game, the main ambition of cultural constructivists is more malignant. It is to deny the concept of scientific truth itself. The notion of truth is replaced by arbitrary convention, rules or decisions. Truth, we are told, is no more than what is expedient to believe. In this way, the unmistakable and enduring truth-seeking character of science itself is assimilated into collectivist dogma. Truth itself as a category is seriously under question in our intellectual world today. Even the truth of hard science, it is questioned whether there can be such a thing as truth. The intellectual battleground is no longer fought in physics, it's no longer fought in biology classes. The intellectual battleground is now in English One, of all places. Because now the challenge is, can you say anything, can you write anything, can you express words in any way that carry any concept of truth or meaning? Or is it only the reader who makes up whatever meaning he wants to make up? Because after all, we all interpret it differently, don't we? And you think that it means one thing, I think it means another thing. It's what I think that counts, not what's written on the page. And if you can't write anything on a page, then it doesn't matter whether it's the theory of relativity or whether it's Alice in Wonderland. It's much the same. It's what you make of it that counts. And yet, no one ever likes being lied to, do they? Don't you hate it when people tell you a lie? Isn't it the most detestable thing? And if there is no such thing as truth, and there's no such thing as absolutes, and there's no such thing as being able to write truth, well, does it matter that Miss Debendenko was actually Miss Darvill? Her Ukrainian truth is as good as any other Ukrainian truth, even if it's all wrong. Let me give you a little test. A true-false test. Here's a set of little suggestions. Tell me whether they're true or false. Hands up those who think it is true that the world is round, not flat. Hands up those who think it's false that the world is round, not flat. Sorry, the trues have it. Better tick true there, David. Hands up those who think Napoleon was the greatest general. Hands up those who think that it's false that Napoleon was the greatest general. I wonder if it had been different if they hadn't been dropping bombs. Yes, okay. False, put down false there. Hands up those who think Jesus died by crucifixion. Hands up those who think it's false that Jesus died by crucifixion. There's a Muslim in our midst. Good. True there. Hands up those who think that Napoleon played Shield cricket for New South Wales. We've got a few Queenslanders. Hands up those who think that it's false, the Napoleon plan. Good, okay, that's good. Hands up things that it's true that God existed. Exists. Hands up those who think it's false that God exists. Okay, we've got true there. Now, which one was the hardest one? Which is the hardest one of those to answer? Napoleon being the greatest general, that one, or Napoleon being the cricket player? No, the general, yes. That's the hard one, isn't it? Because it's not really a question of true and false, is it? We need another category for that. I mean, it's a judgment, it's a value that we might have. I might think he's the greatest general, you might think Genghis Khan was greater, or you may think, well, there's any kinds of people you could think were greater, the grand old Duke of York. So what we need is another column called opinion. For there are some issues that are not true, false, they're issues of opinion. So we can tick Napoleon was the greatest, is just a matter of opinion. But then I've got a problem with that when I look at that, because it's also my opinion that the world is round. It's also my opinion that Jesus was crucified. It's also my opinion that Napoleon didn't play cricket. It's also my opinion that God exists. See, opinion goes with everything, doesn't it? And so I've opinion, and there are people who don't share that opinion. There are people who have the opinion that the world is not around. There are people who have the opinion that Jesus was not crucified. All the Muslims, the Quran teaches that Jesus wasn't crucified. Well, was he crucified or wasn't he crucified? Well, it's all a matter of opinion. Is it all a matter of opinion? Or is there a true-false category as well? If everything is a matter of opinion, well, I don't believe it is. I think there are some things that are only opinion, but there is a reality, and we should try and shape our opinions by the reality of what is true or what is false. You see, I may not believe in gravity. I might have the opinion that gravity is a load of nonsense. But all the positive thinking in the world will not help me and save me if I jump off the Three Sisters. All the way down, I can continue to discuss that it's just a deconstructionist myth. I needn't worry about it. I'm going to be reconstructed down below. It's not true. It's just a matter of opinion. And your opinion is as good as mine. There is true, there is false, and we've got to try and form our opinions upon reality. What of God and God talk? Is it only an opinion? It's because it's only an opinion that you're not allowed to discuss it in tertiary education or in the HSC. Because the world has placed it, the academic world has placed it in that column called opinion. Only opinion. Therefore, it's not open for discussion. You want to bring a tutorial class to an end at any university in Australia? Just drop God into the conversation. Why is it that you think, what are the causes of the First World War? Because Adam rebelled against God. I tried it in third year high school in my history class. In my exam, I wrote Christian answers for all the exam questions. What hurt was not the total and abject failure, but the two-hour lecture from the history teacher afterwards. Naturally, of course, it was a Christian school. No, I would actually say more accurately a church school, but I won't mention which kind of church because the chairman's close to me. Romans chapter 1. Let's turn to Romans 1. Verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. I'm going to read it all for us. We've had it beautifully read for us a few moments again, but take those first couple of points, verses 18 to 20 there. God is there, and God is knowable. His invisible qualities, his power, his divine nature have clearly been seen and understood in creation. But notice being God, that he is knowable not because of our cleverness, not because of our rational reflection, not because of our empirical inquiries, not because of human discovery. He is knowable because he has chosen to make himself known. Because he has made it plain to them. We know because he wants us to know. Because he is God.
That is, we know because of revelation, because he's told us. You can't work it out. Who was my childhood hero? Who was the person that in the 1970s when I was a child, I desperately, good for Miss Demidenko, good for me, I desperately wanted to be like. When I grew up, I just wanted to do the things. Who was my childhood hero? Without me telling you, you cannot know. Rational reflection won't tell you. Empirical inquiry won't tell you. Your cleverness won't tell you. Only I can tell you. It is a piece of information that is in my sovereignty, my control. It is my piece of information. Do you want to know who it was? Now, why am I being rude to the audience? I'll show you why I'm being rude to the audience. Because knowledge is not a right, it's a gift. That's one of the fundamental things that atheistic humanity and, I'm sorry to say, Christian humanity has not understood in the last 200 years. Knowledge is not a right, it is a gift. You've got no right to know it. I may choose to give it to you, but that's my choice. You've got no right. Privacy is very important. God has given to us the knowledge of God. It was his sovereign choice to do so. He has made it plain. But where? How? To whom? Three ways. Three places. In creation, he has made it plain to all people. That's what's being taught here. In the Old Testament, he made it plain to his chosen people, Israel, and through them to other people. And in the New Testament, he has made it plain through his Son, Jesus Christ, to whom has been preached throughout the world. Now, it is the creation revelation that is in view here in Romans chapter 1 that we're talking about. It's not the Old Testament and it's not Jesus, it's the creation revelation. And notice verse 18 to 20, it says, he makes it plain to all people. Anybody who is in creation can see creation, can know creation and can know God from creation. He has made it plain so that it can be plainly seen, verse 20, his eternal power and divine nature. And therefore, verse 21 following, we should be glorifying him and giving thanks to him. And we should not be worshipping creatures and creation, but rather the Creator. I want to take two side points on this just for a moment. If you need little kips and sleeps, have a little kip and sleep. We'll come back to the main point in a moment. Two little side observations. One, worldwide theism is what we find. In reality, the Bible says all people know of God, and when you go and look at peoples around the world, everyone believes in God. Atheism is actually a heresy that comes out of Christianity. It's not what people actually come from. It's a very rare to meet up with tribes of people anywhere. It's not known. Everywhere, people believe in God. Don Richardson produced a little book called Eternity in Their Hearts some time ago. Don Richardson actually spoke here. He lived amongst the people in Irianjaya who were cannibals for 10 years and saw them converted. A wonderful man. He wrote surveying the theism of the world and concluded that monotheism is everywhere in the world. That though people worship all kinds of strange superstitions, if you check into their culture properly, you will discover that behind all their superstitions is a belief in ultimately one true living God. That they don't have much to do with. I was reading the stories of Genghis Khan last night, or earlier this week, because Genghis Khan has been declared the man of the millennium, and I didn't know much about him, so I thought I'd read up on him, and I've had nightmares ever since. He was a brutal murderer. He made Auschwitz and Adolf Hitler look like a Sunday school picnic. I mean, he really was appalling as a human being and what he did. But he was a man of complete religious tolerance, which is interesting. He never prescribed anybody's religion. He accepted all religions of all people everywhere and practiced many of them as much as he could. But even Genghis Khan had a belief in the one overall god called Tengri, whom he didn't know much about and whom he had nothing to do with, but was there. Universal is theism. Second side point is that we often feel like we're caught on the horns of a dilemma by non-Christians on this very subject. You see, what about those who have never heard the gospel? If I say that, well, that's all right, they're saved because they're ignorant, then everybody's saved. Then I mustn't send missionaries to them. They're saved until I go and tell missionaries to them, and then suddenly they hear about Jesus, reject him, and they're no longer saved. Better to leave them in their ignorance. On the other side of the dilemma, the other point of it, is to say, no, no, he condemns those people. Well, then God's not just. And here are ignorant people who have no chance of finding out the information, and they're being punished for their ignorance. So you see the dilemma that we're caught on, and the point of the horns there, either you are saying all are saved and ignorance doesn't matter, you know, they keep them ignorant really, if anything, or you're saying that God is unjust because he punishes ignorant people. But Romans chapter 1 breaks that, destroys it, because Romans chapter 1 tells us, you can see I'm not an artist, someone else, Romans 1 tells us the truth, that everybody does know. There are no ignorant people. What there are people who ignore the truth. There's a world of difference between ignorant, I don't know, I can't know, there's no way of finding out, and people who ignore, I do know, but I don't want to see it. I have heard, but I'm not going to listen. That is ignorance, completely different. And we are going to be judged for ignoring, not for ignorance, because no one is ignorant. All in creation know of God. Come back now. Wake up. That is why, verse 20, men are without excuse. The passage, you see, is not about knowing the truth. The passage is about what we do with the truth. We know God, but how do we act? Do we glorify him? Do we give thanks to him? No. We reject him and turn to foolishness, to the worship of idols, to the images of creation and creatures. And this sad foolishness of human nature is to bow down to statues and to live by star columns. Down our shopping centre at Eastlakes, there's a huge statue out the back of it because it's owned by the Thai people, and so their god has been set up out the back there, gold-covered big statue, twice the size of me, and I'm getting bigger, and it is too, and it's covered with, and there's joss sticks, and there's little elephants, carved elephants, and people leave money and flowers and fruit out for the god that it represents. But of course, it started getting vandalised, so they had to put a big cage all the way around it to protect the god from the people. And the god still couldn't be protected from the people, so they've actually hung now the big wormhole sign on it. So you've got to have the wormhole people protecting God from the people. But nothing protects the god from the birds. And the local dogs who I've seen lift their leg elegantly upon it. Such is the power of their stupid god. But they need to protect. People live by the stars. It's so stupid. You know, the astrologers have actually got all the stars in the wrong place. You think you're a Virgo, you're not. You're something different. You've got all, you're following up the star columns, you're choosing the right person at Beach Mission because you belong to that star. You know he's the right person. He's a Pisces because he's wearing a fish. And so there you are, you see, off you go and marry him. But he's not a Pisces because he's under a different star sign and you're not. It's all wrong. I was down at the East Lake Shopping Centre the other day and they were having one of those new age kind of bizarre things, and they had all these different stalls out with people, and you could get your palms read. There were tarot cards, there were people bumping, putting bumps on heads, and there was one of the big stalls was the crystal stall. You could buy all kinds of crystals. And I picked up their leaflet because it was free. Cheap little leaflet. Crystal chart. There are 50 different crystals listed here. Agate, a variety of chalcedony, can be used to stimulate analytical capabilities and precision, provides for perceptiveness to situations. Amazonite, a variety of feldspar, a stone of spirituality and contentment, provides for pacification and eliminates aggravation. Amber, fossilized pine tree resin, electrifying, relieves fear and problems of depression and tiredness. And 50 of them, they can all do different things for you. It doesn't tell you what to do with them. Whether to put them under your pillow, wear them around your neck, shove them up your nostrils, it doesn't tell you what to do with them. But it does tell you that they've got to be dedicated. Dedication. It is recommended that all new crystals be dedicated. Hold crystal while consciously willing it to be used only in love, in light, and for the good of all. You wouldn't want the dark, evil force to take over, would you? And you know what? These crystals that are doing such wonderful things for you, they get dirty because you've got crystal cleansing instructions here. Many methods may be used for cleansing the crystals, which following, place the crystal in a large cluster, usually amethyst, for 12 to 24 hours. But it's only 11, it might go off.
Or place the crystal in moonlight for 12 hours. You're loony enough to be sitting out there, aren't you? Place the crystals amongst flowers. It is such arrant foolishness and stupidity, but the people were lined up two or three thick at the counter. And next to it was a Christian brother selling or leaving out free Christian literature, and no one was going to his counter. But there were 50 or 60 people lining up to buy their crystals. The foolishness, the madness, the stupidity. Some of you are offended that I've made fun of it. Some of you are offended that the rest of you laughed at it. Those of you who are offended, you have a deep mental problem. Think. Think. You are wrong. It is stupid. Understand it. A crystal will do nothing for your level of aggravation. Give me the crystal if you like. I'll still be aggravated with the stupidity of people who waste their money buying such things. But why are people like this? I tell you why they're like this. It's because the truth is intolerable. That is why they are so foolish, because they ignore him and turn to other things. The answer's back there in Romans 1:18. They suppress the truth. Why? Because the truth is intolerable to them. For the truth is, you and I are not God. We do not rule ourselves. We do not rule our world. We didn't make ourselves, and we are accountable to somebody else, somebody greater than us. I am not the boss of me. I was made not for my pleasure, but for somebody else's pleasure. I owe him everything, even my very existence. And that truth is intolerable to rebellious, arrogant minds and hearts who want to run their own life their own way, not realizing it's not their life. It's God's life that has been given to you to live his way. And I should be living to glorify him and give thanks to him. We don't deny the truth of God. We suppress it. We ignore it. We repress it. We censor the truth. And we do it by wickedness. See, wicked, it's not an intellectual problem with the truth. It's the moral, spiritual problem with the truth. For we turn from the truth into lies to become foolish. But our motivation is there in verse 18. Our motivation is wickedness. We do not want this truth that will control our lives. We do not want God to run our lives. Let me tell you quickly the story of Margaret Mead. Margaret Mead is the anthropologist who studied the Samoan culture in the earlier part of this century and wrote it up. And she wrote it up most extraordinarily. She told us that people there had no sexual repressions. Free love was practiced amongst all adults in the community and teenagers in the community without any feel of guilt or shame or any censorship. People were married, but it didn't matter because you could sleep with other married partners and you had children, but it never mattered whose children they were, the father of the child. It was of no significance because the whole community raised up all the children communally and happily. And the children were raised up there were hardly any suicide. It was unknown of because everybody was happy in the Samoan culture because they were freed from that kind of puritanical sexual repression of Western Christian culture. Margaret Mead was, in public terms, the foremost anthropologist of the 20th century. She may not have been in academic world, but she was the one who put anthropology on the map as a subject that people would study. And she was the leader of cultural relativism. You see, she was the leader of saying, look, morality is not absolute. You go to a different culture, there's different morality. Even on something that you would think was so absolute as husband and wife and parents and children, even that, you go to Samoa, they even do that differently. There is no right and wrong. There's just different ways you've been raised. And she was the leader of the sexual revolution of this century, which, my friends, has been profound. My mate Gertrude Himmelfarb, she writes in a history and has traced it out in the statistics of England and Wales. The percentage of illegitimate births in England and Wales from 1801 to 1991 has been charted. Nearly 200 years of it. From 1801 to 1961... the percentage varied between 5 and 7% of births were illegitimate births. From 1961 to 1991, it has risen to 30%. That is a revolution, friends. That is a massive revolution.
And of course in 1969 to 1991 was the periods of maximum contraceptive advice and availability and freedom of abortion. So in the period in which you had the most control over reproduction, you have seen figures that have hardly varied for 180 years skyrocket to 30%. A massive revolution, and Margaret Mead and her cultural relativism was a key part in the establishment of that revolution in this century. Margaret Mead has now been found to have been a complete phony. An Australian anthropologist whose religious connections I have no knowledge of at all, because that's not irrelevant at all, has debunked Margaret Mead by thorough research in Samoa. Everything she found out was actually wrong. Their sexual morality was high and principled both before they became Christian and after they've become Christian. Adultery was something always frowned upon. Children were not shared around in the community. And Margaret Mead herself only spent a few months there, didn't live amongst the people and never learnt their language. We've even found some of the people who'd said we told her what she wanted to hear. It was a complete and utter fraud. Why? Why did Margaret Mead do it? And why did the intellectual world believe her? I know why Margaret Mead did it. I found out in the history in a biography of Margaret Mead I read earlier this year. She was married as a postgraduate student to a theological student of all things. But when she was in New York, she committed adultery. Filled with grief and shame about it, she travelled across America on the way to Samoa, leaving her husband to finish his studies. On the way across, she stopped in with her old tutor in the Rockies, a woman with whom she shared a lesbian relationship for some time. When she went out to Samoa on the boat home, she met up with another anthropologist and started an adulterous relationship with him. They went to Paris, where she wrote up her results of the Samoan investigation. Her husband came over and joined her in Paris, and the three of them lived as a sexual union of three people. She divorced her husband and went off with her anthropologist's second husband to the Sepik River in New Guinea, where she met up with another anthropologist, and she lived with two men down by the Sepik River until her lesbian lover from the Rockies came and joined them, and then she lived with all three of them. There is the great intellectual giant of the academic world of anthropology. Why did she do it? You only have to read the biography, don't you? She was not talking about Samoa, she was talking about herself. Her own rejection of God and the foolishness that followed. Why did the world believe it? Because it was the message the world wanted to hear. Freud had already told us that we were sexually repressed. Mind you, Freud had a very kinky relationship with his sister-in-law. And his disciple, Jung, he told us we're sexually repressed. Mind you, he'd seduced his patients. He'd be struck off today, I'm glad to say. It all fitted with the truth that we wanted to hear in the 20th century. It was all a lie. See verse 23, they exchange the truth for the lie, and they build then a tangled web of deceit and increasing foolishness. You laugh at the foolishness of the crystals and the New Age, but the modern enlightened worldview is not any much more sensible. For the worldview of the Enlightenment has come to an end. Rationalism and empiricism have been found wanting with no answers, and postmodernism has arrived. The irrationality of which this Australian Weekend article is talking is in amongst us now. For people have given up in the hope of finding the truth because they've started on the wrong foundation, that God is not there. Alan Bloom, Paul Johnson, Mr. Jones has started to debunk it all. The whistle is finally being blown on the Western intellectual imperialism. Alan Bloom and his Closing of the American Mind, Paul Johnson on the intellectuals, Jones on the degenerate moderns, they are already blowing the whistle and saying it's a phony, it's a fraud. Marx was a fraud. Freud was a fraud. Mead was a fraud. It was all a dreadful mistake. Unfortunately, the Christians haven't been at the forefront of doing this. There's an interesting book by Ravi Zacharias that you might like to pick up. I don't know if it's in our bookshop or not, A Shattered Visage, The Real Face of Atheism. But it's becoming apparently clear that the intellectuals of the last 150 years have been as foolish as the crystal gazers. Bertrand Russell, the great logician, was an illogical, immoral man. He believed in free love until one of his wives started practicing it. The only person of the working class Karl Marx had anything to do with was the slave that he kept downstairs. He never paid her any wages. He gave her a baby and he wouldn't acknowledge her. He kicked her out. The only woman that he really had anything to do with from the working class. He was himself a terrible boss. Starling, the great darling of the Western mind and intellectuals in the 1930s. Malcolm Bruggeridge, he was writing for the Manchester Guardian, the great intellectual left kind of newspaper. There was a day in the 1960s that if you didn't carry around a copy of the Manchester Guardian, you were a kind of Philistine. Muggeridge, he was writing, he thought Stalin was wonderful, like all the atheists did in those days. He went across to Stalin's Russia, he saw what was there, and he realised that Stalin was as much a monster as Hitler. He wrote back to the Guardian his reports, and the Guardian refused to publish it. They censored the information. It was the opening of the eyes of Malcolm Muggeridge, who came to believe in God because of the intolerance of the atheists on truth. Or Rousseau, the father of modern education, complete pig of a man. He had five children by different women. He left all of them in orphanages, even though he knew that in those orphanages, most of the children died within the first year or two of their lives. Four of them he left behind without even so much as giving them a name. He was a murderer of children, and he is the father of child education and processes today. And people pay attention to his philosophy. What a foolishness we have gone on with in the last 200 years since men have turned their back on God. These people were living God's wrath, because the wickedness leads you to believe the lie, and God then gives them up, verse 24, gives them up, verse 26, gives them over, verse 28, to their lie. That is the wrath of God. Let them go believing what they believe and see the chaos and catastrophe that they create. The futile, foolish darkness of their minds. So verse 29, they've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They're gossip, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful, invent ways of doing evil. You want to see that in reality? Go visit your local video shop and just look what the videos are about. Look what our creative geniuses have given to us in these last years of the wonders of our technology. Look how we have used it to create an imaginary world of dreams and lusts and fascinations and fantasies. It is just Romans 1. It is evil and corrupt throughout. Michael Medved, a Jewish writer, has written a very interesting book called Hollywood versus America that I'd commend to you on this matter. But enough. Let's look at this lie more carefully as I change the text. Come across to Genesis 3 and remember what happened. For what did the woman do? She believed the lie. She didn't eat an apple. She ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And what was the lie she believed back there in Genesis 3? The first part of it, which occurs for you in verse 4, is you will not die. That's a lie. The second part of it is in verse 5. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. She was like God, created in his image, but now she is to be like God in a new way. She is now to know good and evil. How does God know good and evil? He knows good and evil because he makes good and evil. He declares this is good, he declares that's evil. She is now to become the person who is going to declare what is good, what is evil. Verse 22, you'll find they actually do now know God. They do stand as the moral arbiters, as the moral rule makers of the universe. And of course we are not God. At the heart of sin is believing lies. For lies have great power. Enormous power. What kind of power do you think the devil has? Pitchfork? Horns? Some kind of magnetic force? Beam me up? The devil's power is lies. Come with me to Jesus' teaching in John chapter 8. John chapter 8. Where Jesus describes the devil for us. John chapter 8. You belong to your, verse 44, Jesus says to them in a most politically incorrect, rude and abrasive fashion, you belong to your father, the devil. Pretty hard to say that to anyone these days, isn't it? Give it a try sometime. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. The devil controls us by lying. That's what it's about. And that is what the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ and the gospel is about. It's speaking the truth. See, Jesus' view is radically different. Look back here into verse 34. Not radically different to what he's teaching here, but radically different to our kind. I'm sorry, I'm skipping some because I can see time's against us here. Jesus' view, verse 34. I tell you the truth, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. These are the children and the slaves of the devil. Anyone who sins. Why? Well, because we think we're like Eve, like Adam. You reject God and then you can live your own life your own way. But if you reject God, you believe the devil. And if you believe the devil, then you are now a slave of the devil and a child of the devil. You don't set yourself up as God in the world. You set him up as God in the world. Where does the devil get his power from? Us. We give it to him whenever we believe his lies. That's where he gets it from. And where does he lose it? From God and Christ, whenever the gospel of truth is preached. Once you've come to accept the devil's lie, then you can only go to more lies and more sin, which will lead you to more foolishness and to darkness and futility under the wrath of God. But look at Jesus in verse 31. To the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." The power of God is the word of God, because it is the word of truth. And truth liberates, as lies enslave. We sadly underestimate the power of lies. We who have been set free from holding to the teachings of the devil, we who have been set free by the Son because we have believed his truth and followed his words, we must not now tolerate the lies and the foolishness of lies that are all around about us in the world. But sadly, I keep seeing Christians doing exactly that, tolerating the lies of foolishness. So let me give you about tolerating lies. Five areas you see it in today. Firstly, there's the Christian cringe factor in respect to the world. The world has kept on putting us down, doesn't it? We Christians are nerds, stupid, unathletic, old-fashioned, fundamentalist, bigoted, no fun, no brains kind of people. And gradually, over a period of time, you come to believe it. Gradually, over a period of time, we have to start proving ourselves, have to start proving that a Christian can be fashionable, a Christian can be a scientist, a Christian can be a pop star, a Christian can be a sportsman, a Christian can be a professional, whatever it may be. We've got to prove ourselves all the time to the world. And those Christians who succeed in proving themselves, who become the great Christian footballer or the great Christian scientist or the great whatever it is, can never then critique the thing they've become great in. The non-Christian scientist can critique scientism, but the Christian scientist can't critique scientism because people will say, oh, yes, he's not a good scientist, he's a Christian. Christians can never be a scientist. So the most fanatic people I've ever met for the wonders of science are Christian scientists because they're under the cringe factor. And so our pop music has to be like theirs. Sydney Morning Herald. Heavens above, church can help sex life. 17th of January, no pictures. Almost 40% of people who go to church once a week or more say that they are either delighted or very pleased with their sex life, compared with 30% of the non-church goers this nationwide survey has provided. Why are they surprised? It's been known for years. Quick, cheap sexual gratification is unsatisfying. Relationships, profound, deep, loving relationships, that relationship that goes for 32 years can express sexuality and enjoy its sexuality. When sex is an expression of a deep relationship, it's wonderful. When sex is a quick hit and a quick gratification, It's awful. We know that. It's in any book that you want to study. It's everywhere. But it's a great surprise. We Christians who believe in monogamous lifelong marriage, we have a good sex life. Christians couldn't have a good sex life. They're nerds. They don't have a sex life. They don't know what the word means. My friends, Christians live longer, have better health, are wealthier, are happier, are better educated, are more tolerant, are more musically trained, and have greater cultural awareness than the non-Christians in our society. I can demonstrate each and every one of those things. And it should not surprise any person in this room, but it surprises us all a bit, doesn't it? Because we're under the cringe factor. We've believed the lies of the world. Don't tolerate the lies. And we tolerate the world's lies and the politically correct agenda of today too. Are we willing to question it, critique it and oppose it? No. The kind of literary criticism of the world, rather than critiquing it, we've adopted it. And we talk in relativistic terms about the Bible. Well, I've actually got a black African hermeneutic, and I've got a feminist reading on this, or I've got a waspy kind of reading on this, and therefore totally unacceptable. We accept the deconstructionist theories that the author's intent is irrelevant or unknowable or just a reflection of his own political bias, to be ignored or possibly deconstructed, and that the reader is the only person. The way I like to read this passage is to think. The way you're reading it is not thinking at all. The way to read a passage is to think, what is the author saying? God has spoken, our job is to listen and to do. But no, we're accepting the classes of English 1 deconstructionism, which leads you into complete meaninglessness. And we tolerate the world's lie that style is more important than content. Of course it is. There's no content. Nothing ever means anything. All that matters is how well it's put over. Here's my mate Gade again. The values of relativism are not merely out there, they're in us, certainly within me. One of the things I've noticed about myself, for example, is that I am more inclined to react to speakers' style than their content. If they speak politely and in a self-effacing manner, if they use self-deprecating humour and seem open to the opinions of others, I react positively, even if their teaching is flawed. On the other hand, if they are strident or abrasive, if they appear to be absolutely confident of their position, I don't like them regardless of their position. Why? Because deep in my gut, I care less about truth than about style. Emotionally, I'm a relativist. I'm not alone. 2 years ago, I was speaking at a conference of evangelicals. The keynote address was delivered by a well-known figure, a major writer of the evangelical circuit. As is almost always the case, he was well-received. People laughed, people were moved, and when he finished, he was given a standing ovation. There was only one problem. According to what Christians have believed for almost 2,000 years, he was not speaking the truth. Many non-Christians have shared the convictions he was speaking. However, over the years, it's not been difficult for Christians to figure it out, but it is difficult for us in our age, even those of us who claim to be heirs of Orthodox tradition. Why? Because we care more how the speaker makes us feel than what he actually says. Style over content. I kind of like that paragraph. For selfish reasons. And we prefer process over results. I won't give you that one. Time's against me. It's much the same as style over content. Let me give you the last one, and I won't give you the main fifth heading. I'll drop that in some other day. Worst of all, really, is we tolerate liars. Oh, not in the political arena. That doesn't matter to us, really, one way or another. I mean, which liar are you going to vote in next? Now, in the church, the false teachers, the shepherds, the elders, the prophets, we will hear of no criticism. Rather, what we must do is join in union with them. We must cause no schism. We must be united. We must learn of the truth that they hold, rather than ever declaring the lies that they teach.
We submit to their office and their work because, after all, they are the Reverend, the Right Reverend, the Most Reverend, the Venerable. We Anglicans have got any number of titles. And it's important for world peace, for church unity, for human harmony, that we never say negative things about anybody else. A friend of mine in America, an ordained Anglican Episcopal minister there, was dismissed from his church recently. There was a 2-year investigation of his life. The bishop insisted he go and see a psychiatrist every week to get a psychiatric report from him. He had to do it at his own expense. There was a counsellor brought in from the Unitarian Church, they're not even Trinitarians, to investigate the conflicts he had with other people in his church. He was placed under an Anglo-Catholic, ex-Roman Catholic priest as a spiritual director to tell him how he was to conduct his own personal life. At the end of 2 years, he failed all the tests and was dismissed from the ministry and dismissed for his orders revoked from the Episcopal Church of America. The bishop won. It was a little while later, the bishop retired slightly early, leaving a note beside his body that he blew his head off with a gun. And the note set out the adulterous lifestyle he'd been living with members of the diocese all over that part of America. My friend stands for the truth of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. He was seeing people converted. He was teaching the Bible. He's like any man. He's a sinner. He has his faults and his flaws. But he was on God's side doing God's work. But the ecclesiastical officials are adulterous, heretical, immoral, and decadent. And we tolerate them. Did you notice that I said I was ashamed of being an Anglican yesterday? If I'm not ashamed of being an Anglican, then you shouldn't trust me. Mind you, that's the church I've chosen to belong to, not yours. So can you imagine what I think of yours?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.